Our first guest on the Conversation Hour today is John Pilger. His new film is called The War on Democracy, and it has a look at what John says is the fading US empire and the way it's been meddling in the affairs of states in the Central American and South American region, really throughout the modern era. John Pilger, welcome back to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you.
Give us a Cook's tour, first of all, from Bolivia to Venezuela and right across to Chile, the ambit of this film.
I'm not sure it's fading, by the way. I think it's being challenged in Latin America, but it's, I think the US is, in economic terms and military terms, a pretty powerful operation. But certainly in Latin America, what has happened in the last few years is, in a number of countries, with varying degrees of success, there's been the rise of what's called social movements, popular movements. And up close, they're very, very interesting because it's about grassroots and people at without the basis that we normally think about grassroots democracy, that is perhaps local councils, trade unions, and so on. It comes out of actually great movements of often the unemployed, people thrown off their land, people made redundant from mines, and so on. This has happened from Venezuela to Bolivia to Ecuador to Argentina throughout. And it's something that's recurred over probably over 100 years in Latin America. It's a phenomenon, if you like, that keeps coming back. And it's come back now, backed. The power behind it is Venezuela's oil. And the real threat to U.S. domination in Latin America is the unity, a regional unity that never happened before in that continent. It's amazing to think when there's unity in other, like in Europe and elsewhere, but not in Latin America. And with oil, Venezuela's oil, for instance, Argentina's debt has been virtually paid off. There are sort of these bridges being built between countries, which means it doesn't mean that the U.S. is being pushed out of Latin America entirely, but it's being very seriously challenged for the first time in the modern era.
Look, you spent time traveling with Hugo Chavez.
Uh-huh.
What's he like?
Personally?
I mean, we should perhaps, if for anybody who doesn't understand, he's the president of Venezuela.
Yeah.
Probably one of the most interesting political figures in the world at the moment, because he is standing up to and defying the United States, which means if we go on the past experience of defiant presidents of American republics, he has a short life expectancy. So what's he like?
Well, it's interesting that when you're there, you don't get the sense of him actually defying the United States. It's almost as if the U.S. sees him as an obstacle, when frankly it's a nationalist government, because in economic terms, he's actually not defying the U.S. He's supplying the U.S. with 15% of its oil, and that will continue. He runs a basic capitalist economy. It's nothing like Cuba, as it's been compared with. But what he has done with oil, which no Venezuela leader before him has done, is recognize the majority of the people. And what makes him, as you said, well, for me, what makes him so interesting is this man has the kind of electoral credentials over a period of 10 years where he's doubled his popularity that, you know, the likes of Howard and Rudd and all the rest of them would die for. He is an authentic product of this movement in Latin America, which is basically an indigenous movement that calls itself the Invisible People. You know, there's no continent in the world where societies are so divided, so polarized between the well-off, the elite, and the majority who live on the hills and barrios. He represents them for the first time. Personally, he's a very humorous person, and a lot of the to and fro which comes across in the Western press's abuse is tongue-in-cheek. I got that immediately, traveling with him a couple of days. I mean, he has his crowds roaring with laughter. he'll turn up with an armful of books from Victor Hugo to Dickens even Ian McEwan or whatever, and start and will read to them and relate the passages to the passages to their particular lives. His popularity is very interesting and quite extraordinary to see a politician as popular as this. You know, whereas, you know, in our societies, all of us are either skeptical or cynical or couldn't care less, really, about them as they pop up on television every night. But not there. It's a movement.
Is he able to redistribute the wealth that's generated by the oil to the poor people of Venezuela?
I think he will be able to if he goes further. At the moment, he's very cautious about, not interestingly, as an alleged bogeyman of the US, of not upsetting the multinationals, of not upsetting actually the oligarchs in his own country. What they've done in Venezuela is remarkable in that the bureaucracy is in the hands of the opposition, the educated class. Mm. So in order to redistribute wealth, he's had to set up a parallel bureaucracy. So you go into a town, there are two local governments. There is the old oligarchic local government with its sort of servile media, and then there's a new communal council with its local assembly electing and making all sorts of decisions, being backed financially by the state. So it's quite a slow process, but when you consider all the problems he's had of coups and so on, you go into the barrios, there is a modern health center, there is a local supermarket where food sells for 30% of the price in the main chains. There are new schools, parallel universities. Again, the universities are run by the opposition, basically, so he set up new universities. It's almost two worlds. But he has made what he has done for the majority, and I haven't seen this, I have to say, traveling around for many years. He's given people with nothing, or rather the movement has, confidence. You know, you have these fantastic discussions with people about the future and what they're doing and where their kids are going and so on. The sort of political discussions that you just don't have in Australia or Britain or elsewhere anymore. Mm. And it's that almost indefinable confidence in people that things are possible. Now, whether or not they'll all pan out for them, I don't know.
Only time will tell. You do interview a couple of people who are leading industrialists and business figures who say, look, it's time to pack up and leave. This is all going to end very sadly
and
tragically.
Well, they would, wouldn't they? I mean, and that, as I said, you know, one of them, the Austrian chap who's been there for 30 years, Caracas is rock and roll. I mean, people are driving around in luxury cars. You know, they're living the most fantastically, rather obscenely wealthy life, people like him. And yet, because they have lost power of the government, then suddenly it's 1917, Bolshevik Revolution.
I remember hearing
absolute
people
nonsense.
I remember hearing people saying the same thing. Business people saying when the Labor government was elected, first with Whitlam, then with Hawke, saying, "Oh, that's it for us. We all should pack up and leave before everything turns to mud." For me, the standout moments in the film, John, are when you're interviewing a former CIA operative.
Yes.
Now, his name is Dwayne Claridge, you've just reminded me, and they are moments of quite riveting tension between you and him as you challenge him and he then challenges you back. Tell us about Dwayne Claridge and what he knows and what he's done.
Well, I ended up, maybe this is not the right word, but almost admiring his honesty. You know, to appreciate, you sit in front of some people and they flannel away to you and they're really not saying what they're thinking and so on.
No, they're playing a role.
This man didn't. You know,
what was his part?
He was chief of CIA operations in the 1980s in Latin America. that's when Reagan was conducting his various operations.
The Contras. And
the Contras, El Salvador, with Chile thrown in and so on. So he was a big man.
How did you get onto him? Why was he prepared to talk?
Well, he'd written a book. You see, these people think they have a place in history and they really want to explain it. And so here was an international filmmaker who was prepared, and I said, well, look, if you speak your mind, we'll run pretty well all of it. You know, I gave him virtually a guarantee, and that's what happened because he spoke his mind. I mean, I've met quite a few CIA people, former and serving, and, you know, with a few beers inside them, they will speak like that.
Well, how does he speak?
Because it's, you know, we have to overthrow, what's his name, he says, in Chile. I said to him, well, what's his name? It was Salvador Allende. Couldn't even remember the name of the government.
He had to go.
But then to him, to Duane Claridge, it didn't matter what his name was. The fact was that the Chilean government was, as they saw it then, contrary to American interests. And
he says point blank, we will do whatever we need to do to protect what we think is good for us.
You like it all lump it world.
Yeah.
He says, and he debated whether hundreds or thousands had been killed. He
shrugged his shoulders if it was only hundreds, as if to say, well, so what?
Yeah, I think he was I think we had, in that interview, a glimpse of the authentic voice of crude power. Sometimes people think it's all very sophisticated and, you know, there are... You know, it's all bureaucratic and people in suits and so on. And diplomatic, it isn't.
Mm. Well, of course, he could be emboldened by the publication during the Bush years of that American doctrine of security and defence and extension of power. I forget what the document's called, but it's the one that says quite bluntly and categorically, America is the supreme power in the world and it will not tolerate any challenge.
That's right. Yes.
And that what America, and of course this is a common argument in the right-wing think tanks, that the power itself gives America the right to do whatever it wants to do in its own interests. Mm. But another interesting character that I think you spent time with was Evo Morales.
Yes.
in Bolivia.
I didn't actually spend time with him, but I certainly spent time in Bolivia and around his people, yes.
So what's he like? Because he's got a couple of things going for him. One is that he is trying to recover some sort of Bolivian autonomy from the international corporations that have, to all intents and purposes, taken over the country. But the other interesting thing is that he is from the indigenous people.
Yeah. It's the first indigenous government... fully indigenous government in Latin America, first to win in Bolivia. And when you think that the indigenous people, I mean, racism is a big issue in Latin America. When you think that the indigenous people in Bolivia weren't even allowed in the plaza outside the national parliament in La Paz, I mean, they operated, I think, at the level of... often the way we treat our own Aboriginal people, certainly the way mixed race and black people have been treated in other countries. So to have a government in the hands of the indigenous is an extraordinary thing, but it is, in a sense, a huge provocation to those who really hold economic power. And Bolivia has the continent's second biggest... gas reserves. It's a very rich country, even though it's the poorest country in terms of its people on the continent. So Morales has Morales is at the moment, Bolivia's faded from the news, but I can tell you that there's a huge battle going on in that country between his government, which doesn't control the National Assembly, under their rather complicated constitutional arrangements. It's still controlled by the wealthy in the lowlands, and there's every possibility that the government could be overthrown by a military coup. So democracy there is a very precarious thing, and it's one that, again, has come, Morales has been thrown into this position by these popular movements, by people just saying we've had enough of these oligarchs running our country. It is black and white, in a sense.
Yeah. The overview you get, though, is that there's some sort of resurgence of grassroots movements that are at last freeing themselves from the strings, the puppetry from Washington. What do you predict as George W. Bush enters the last, what is it now, 15, 16 months, I think it is, of his term, and the likelihood of there being a Democrat president, maybe Hillary Clinton, maybe Barack Obama, who knows, over from there?
Sorry, I think it depends on if or when he invades Iran, which I think is very likely, because that will throw, it'll be a catastrophe in terms of the Middle East, but it'll be a catastrophe for resources as well. And Venezuela probably has the world's greatest reserves of so-called heavy oil, which will actually push the power, the resources power, onto Latin America. If the U.S. does attack Iran, however that'll come out, I don't know. But let's say it disables Iran, which is at the moment, I think, the second or third biggest supplier of oil.
So you're saying then the Middle East as a source of oil becomes stressed?
Well, it becomes as it is at the moment. Yeah. I mean, you know, Iraq is not producing the oil it should be.
Not as much, no. But there's still plenty coming out of there.
There is still
Iran,
there,
Iraq,
well,
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yes. But it means, you know, oil, like everything else, all resources, particularly finite resources, now suggest a very precarious world in terms of where it's all going. Mm. And I think that brings it back to Latin America. I think if it goes particularly bad in Iran, it brings pressure on Latin America. It perhaps even brings renewed American pressure on Latin America. I think that the U.S. would have invaded, probably would have invaded Venezuela had it not had Iraq on its hands. So I'm not a futurologist, I can't predict, but if that happens, I think there's a very unstable world ahead.
And if there's no invasion of Iran, because it looks to others, and I think I'm of this view now, that the moment's passed where the prospect of opening up another front in the Middle East for George W. Bush is an impossibility.
Don't underestimate him. Don't underestimate these people. It's both strategic and it's ideological. Mm. And which comes first, we haven't really sorted out yet.
All right, well, there might be another film in it. John, thank you for coming back and congratulations. The War on Democracy is a new film by John Pilger. It opens next Thursday nationally, The War on Democracy.